Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hey, and we're so glad you're back with us today, everyone. I'm Joe Salci. Hi from Stacking Benjamins. And in a minute, we're going to hand over the reins to my friend Linda P. Jones. But before that, if you've ever wondered if there were a way to capitalize on all the online chatter, the millions of investors on social media, well, guess what? Your wait's over. Because the Buzz Index uses the same artificial intelligence techniques used by some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds, and now you can make their edge your edge. It trades under ticker symbol BUZ, the Buzz Index, licensed to an exchange-traded fund. And to find out more, head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. That's moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. Miranda?
Yeah, and thanks for sharing that. It's always interesting to hear about new products in our space. And one of the new products out there right now is Health IQ. It's a life insurance company that rewards you for living a health conscious lifestyle. So Health IQ offers special rates to those who are involved in a health conscious lifestyle, whether that means exercising regularly, eating a plant-based diet, or focusing on a low-carb diet. These special rates are more than just great marketing. It's way better. 56% of Health IQ's clients get their exclusive special rates. You can save up to 33% on your health insurance if you qualify. So head on over to healthiq.com/moneytree to see if you qualify to save on your life insurance. So Health IQ is the only place you can go to find the special rates you deserve. Once again, that's healthiq.com/moneytree. And now we'll go ahead and turn it over to Linda. We've got listener questions today, and it should be a lot of fun.
Woohoo!
All right. Thanks, Miranda. It's so much fun to get questions from our listeners. We love interacting with you, and thank you for writing in these fabulous questions. Our first question comes from Kai. And Kai says, hello, Money Tree Podcast panel. I'm a 43-year-old man from Norway. Oh, that's exciting. Thank you for listening to us all the way from Norway, who's just recently entered the fascinating world of investing, and he's learned so much from us. He loves our show. And as a long-term investor, he's in small cap, mid cap, large cap, international, and emerging markets. And most of those are US ETFs. The other two are index funds from a Norwegian provider. His strategy is to build a total return portfolio because he doesn't like the idea of locking up money in a retirement account. And he's been looking at REITs because they don't correlate with the rest of his other assets. He doesn't have any bonds, but he wants to know our thought on his strategy and how to make it even more diversified and potent. Many thanks and keep up the good work. Awesome. Doug, what do you have to say to Kai about how he can get more diversified and is his portfolio adequate as it is?
Actually, I'd like to leave the question about getting more diversified to you guys, but I do want to talk about something that's really, really important for people who live outside the United States who are investing in, as Kai said, US ETFs. So if a non-American, which I'm assuming you are, owns a US stock or what's called any asset that has situs in New York, like a piece of real estate, like if you owned a property in Manhattan or something, or US stock or US ETFs, exchange traded funds, those are considered American assets. And if Kai, you should live and be well, but if heaven forfend you were to die, the United States would charge you an inheritance tax, a death duty on the assets you have that are above $60,000. Now, there are ways of dealing with this, but the way of dealing with it is not to simply open a brokerage account and buy these US ETFs. So, you know, if you're just walking down the street and a bus comes and takes you out and you have more than $60,000 there, your heirs are going to have a really, really big problem. And this is a major problem that a lot of people don't know about. So, I know that's not really the topic of your question or the discussion today. People who have this sort of problem should definitely speak to a cross-border investment advisor or just feel free to get in touch with me offline and, you know, online. And I'll be happy to just send you some articles on it to make sure that you don't, all the hard work you're doing to develop a great portfolio. And it sounds, Kai, like you really are doing a great job. Will all be for naught if you end up giving that money to the US IRS.
Well, thank you for pointing that out, Doug. That is something that most people aren't familiar with. And I think that's an important point. So thank you for letting us know. Miranda, what do you think about the diversification with ETFs here? You're an ETF investor and fan.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think he has a pretty diversified portfolio, especially if he has a long time horizon, just with the large caps and the small caps. But I wouldn't mind seeing him add some REITs in there. I really like real estate investment trusts. I have a few of those myself. to kind of add a little real estate exposure to my portfolio, which I enjoy. It works for me. Definitely look at your own risk tolerance and see if it works for you. And then, you know, it doesn't hurt to have some bonds either. I have a few bond funds as well. But you really do want to look at your long-term goals. You want to look at your risk profile and your time frame and figure out if it actually does make sense to add a little more diversity. But I think you're off to a really good start. So congratulations.
All right, great. And Joe, what do you think?
I think that the two things that he's asking for, which are potency, I like that word, in his portfolio, and diversification are two different things. I think if you want your portfolio to be more potent, it needs to be less diversified. And it'll be safer, actually, I think is the best word, if it's more diversified. So I would look up sites, Kai, that have to do with what's called the efficient frontier. And it's Dr. Harry Markowitz won a Nobel Prize for his research on the efficient frontier. And that'll tell you all about mixing your portfolio so it's optimized and diversified in the best way possible for your goals. That's where I'd start.
Okay, great. Our next question comes from Matt. He says he's a 32-year-old married male working as a 1099 contractor in New York State. I have 5 to 6 months expenses saved in an emergency fund. I pay for disability, variable universal life, and health insurance. Max out my SEP. My wife maxes out her 401k. Our household income is $275,000. Car loan is $25,000 at 2.8% interest. Home loan is currently $104,000 at 3.6%. And we pay an additional 10% to premium. I don't plan on home renovations or a new car loan for at least 5 years, but expect to have kids in the near future. We have power of attorney, basic living will, and basic living trust through a legal company. Lastly, I have $88,000 invested in a no transaction fee brokerage account. Asset allocation is 45% in the S&P 500, 30% in small mid caps, 10% foreign large caps, 5% emerging market, and 10% short-term bonds. Where else should I invest our additional income? Am I over-investing in stocks between the brokerage and retirement? Lastly, I don't like the restrictions of 529 plans, and I don't believe the financial institutions will be the same in 20 years as we know them today. I hope this isn't a stupid question, but I feel like I'm missing something. I love your show and appreciate your advice. Well, Matt, no questions are stupid. We appreciate all questions. And let's start with Joe. What do you think about Matt's asset allocation and where can he invest his additional income?
You know, I look at this. Generally, I like it. I don't think he's overinvested in stocks, you know, because he's in so many different types of stocks. I think sometimes we say, do I have too many stocks? And when you look at, he owns small companies, mid-sized companies, large companies, foreign companies, emerging market companies. He's got all of these different things, which are really, he owns a lot of different companies. So I don't look at it as much as being in the stock market as owning a lot of different places. So I don't think he's overexposed to stocks. Man, if I'm looking at the way that Matt's looking at it, you know, take away, I don't feel the way he feels about the 529 plan. I think that if he invests in a 529 plan for his kids' college, I think that's actually a good way to go. But I look at a couple things. You know, at the end of this long run, I think having a car loan might be a mistake. I think that if he got rid of the car loan, that would be fantastic and paid cash for his cars in the future. Sure, it's only 2.8% interest that he's paying, but in a choppy stock market, if he's ahead on his goals, then taking that money and applying it to not having the car loan, I think is a good idea. I'm also not sure, I'd have a lot of questions about the variable universal life, about why he's invested in that. Back in the day, I used variable universal life a lot. As I learned more about them, I used them less and less. So I think variable universal life can be a good life insurance policy for some people, but not nearly the number of people that have them. So I worry about that. I suppose without knowing whether he's ahead or behind on his goals, I can offer a lot more than that.
Yeah, I do like the fact that he's maxing out his SEP and his wife is maxing out her 401k. I think that's phenomenal.
Yeah,
and they could maybe add some REITs or something to their asset allocation. What do you think, Doug? What could they do with their additional income?
Listen, I think one of the things that we're not really seeing here, and I'm a little bit curious about, is just what the budget is of Matt and his family. Are they, I understand that there may be a little bit of extra cash today, but if there are other short-term expenses they have going on, and I certainly like Joe's idea of paying off the car loan, these are things that are going to eat a little bit into your cash flow. But maybe the answer is to really step back and think, what are your big term goals? You're 32. Are you one of these people who could potentially retire at 50? Or are you trying to retire at 60? Or you just love what you do and you want to keep going? If your goal is to be retiring a little early, and it seems like you're earning very well these days, if you could put aside another, let's say $25,000 compared to whatever it is you're saving now, that could make a huge difference in the medium term. So you don't have to be one of these long-term investors. I just think it's something to look at to determine whether saving more today would have a huge lifestyle benefit to you in the future. Not that I'm trying to make you suffer today. And the other point I would make just about the diversification and the asset allocation is realize you are obviously very, very heavily invested in the stock market, which on paper is probably fine. You know, we could all look at Monte Carlo simulations or past performance, which of course does not indicate future returns, and see that, you know, people who invest in the stock market have a lot of potential to do pretty well on the one hand. On the other hand, what would happen if the market were to crash? We have another 2008. Have you lived through something like that before? Would you be able to hold on? And would that in fact be the smart thing for you to do? So those are the questions that that I will raise to Matt. But good for you, man. I think you're doing a great job.
All right. Excellent. Our next question comes from Gary. In your recent podcast about kids and money, Miranda mentioned that her parents still only have investments in 401ks and pensions. Is there something wrong with that? That's me too. I consider myself a savvy but humble investor. I think it makes sense to put most of my money into tax-deferred investments, 401k or IRA, until I reach the contribution or budgetary limit. I have a sizable savings account, about $40,000, and I know I could invest some of that, but I consider that a cushion for the series of periods between layoffs. I'm a professional designer, and although I make a good living, companies seem to consider design a nice to have until a budget cut. I'd love to be able to get more than 1% for my cushion, but I worry about both risk and liquidity. Do you have any advice on a strategy for saving so I can take advantage of market returns while still having a reliable cushion? I love your show and have been listening for at least 2 years now. You have great guests and insightful follow-up discussions. Well, thanks, Gary. We appreciate that. And Joe, what do you think? That 1% cushion, that's a tough thing. You might need that if he gets laid off, but is there somewhere that he could invest it and get more than 1%?
Maybe, but I'm not a huge fan of getting crazy with your cash reserve. I think everybody wants to optimize every piece of the portfolio, and the emergency fund is there for a purpose. Sure, it's losing money to inflation and it's not invested, but man, if something goes wrong, the cool thing is then you could be more aggressive with your portfolio because that money's there. So I think it actually comes out in the wash when you look at, I have freedom from worry with my investments, so I can reliably set those things where they should be and not have to think about what if my muffler's dragging behind my car and I have to go replace it by take some money out and sell stocks when they're low. I don't like, by the way, I think there is something wrong with having money just in 401ks and IRAs, because I like tax diversification. We never know what's going to happen in the future with taxes. Do what Gary's doing now and take advantage of the tax code today, but I also want to have the flexibility to take advantage of the tax code tomorrow. So as an example, let's say that I'm trying to live on $75,000 in retirement, and the tax bracket line is at $60,000. And so now my last dollars are going to be taxed at a much higher rate than the first $60,000 that I make. That last $15,000 will be. If I only have money in a 401k, the only tax thing I can do is take the money out and pay the tax. But if I have money in a Roth or in a regular flexible brokerage account, and I have money in the 401k, now I can take money, let's say it's a Roth mix, I take money out of the pre-tax 401k up to that $60,000 mark, and then the last $15,000 I take out of my Roth. And now I'm living midway up into the higher tax bracket, while the government's only taxing my money in retirement in the lower tax bracket. So I really like tax diversification. I don't like having all my money in a pre-tax position, because it kind of handcuffs me later to whatever taxes look like at the time.
Yeah, well, that's a really good point to also manage your tax strategy. What do you think, Doug?
First, I think Joe really covered a lot of important points here. The one thing that I'm looking at, and just without really knowing the details, it's hard to know. But Gary, you mentioned that you've got 401k or IRA. You know, a lot of times when people leave a job, they keep their money in the 401k of the old company because of inertia. And one of the things I'll often tell people is, you know, you can roll that money into an IRA and then you have control over it. first off, you can control the amount you're paying in fees. You can deal with an IRA that allows you to invest in whatever you want. And normally 401k plans have a limited menu, and it may not be exactly what you're looking to do. So I would just say, in terms of improving your investments inside your tax-deferred money, and again, this is not to say anything bad about what Joe said, because I think he was really right on. But for that money, if you're able to get a little more control of it through an IRA, then go for it. And just to reiterate Joe's point, don't take risk with an emergency fund. It's meant to be there for an emergency, not to be investment money.
That's a great point. And emergencies can happen. And that's why Health IQ uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health conscious people. You can save up to 33% on your life insurance rate by heading over to healthiq.com/moneytree. Health IQ is a one-of-a-kind life insurance company that takes into account health habits like regular exercise and eating habits to lower your life insurance rates. 56% of Health IQ's clients see the best savings on their life insurance. Health IQ is the only life insurance company that uses science and data to prove that health-conscious people live longer and should be rewarded with lower life insurance rates. See if you qualify by getting a free quote today at healthiq.com/moneytree.
And also, Linda, if you've ever wondered if there were a way to capitalize on all that online chatter, the millions of people talking on social media, well, your wait's over, because the Buzz Index uses the same artificial intelligence techniques used by some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds. That's all at your fingertips, and you can now make their edge your edge. The Buzz Index is licensed to an exchange-traded fund. It trades under ticker symbol BUZ, and it provides investors with a portfolio of securities that show the highest degree of positive investor sentiment online. There's no surveys, no guessing. Here's what they do. First, Buzz targets the most mentioned large company U.S. stocks across the social media landscape. The more active the conversation, the greater the reliability of the buzz. And each of the most mentioned stocks is then given an insight score based on Buzz's proprietary analytics. The 75 stocks with the most bullish score, those get included in the index. So each month, the Buzz is tracked to capture the latest big data-driven insights, with 75 of the most bullish scores selected, positioning Buzz to capture the highest return potential. Invest in the wisdom of crowds. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and more information. That's moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. And just before I end this, Linda, I have to say that I use the Buzz Index. Doesn't make it right for you, but it's something that's in my portfolio. But do your own research. Linda, back to you.
Thanks, Joe. Our next question comes from Justin. One of my stocks had a really bad earnings report and is now down 63% from where I bought it. I kept thinking that I wouldn't actually lose money on the stock unless I sold it. I'm also hoping that given enough time, the stock will get back to the price where I bought it. But who knows how long that will take. I also know that I may be losing money on opportunity costs by keeping money in a stock that may be down for a while. What advice can you give for deciding when to stick with a stock when it's down, and when to accept losses, sell, and move on to something else? Thanks for the great show. Well, Justin, I would say that one of the things I've always done with stocks is paid attention to earnings. And if they had a bad earnings report because of one situation that was an outside outlier that isn't likely to repeat, that's one thing. But typically, a bad earnings report means there's more bad earnings reports that are going to follow. And so I've used bad earnings reports as a sell discipline and a reason to cut my losses and move on. So that is probably what I would say. Again, unless that was a one-time, you know, there was a snowstorm or some crazy thing that caused a retailer not to have the earnings that they typically would have, and it's not going to be a repeatable event, that's something else. But if it's just a bad earnings report, it's probably the beginning of a trend. And what really makes stocks rise is consistent earnings, and earnings rising at a rising rate. So if you don't have that, I would suggest that's a stock that you probably don't want to own. Doug, what do you think?
I think that when you own a stock, you have to ask, when you're a stock trader, you have to ask yourself a question every day. If I had some cash now, would I buy this stock? If you're just waiting for the stock to come back to the price where you bought it, just because somehow you think it's magically going to go there, then for sure, that's a mistake. I think you've got to start looking at the fundamentals as if you simply were sitting on a pile of cash today and you're considering the stock. What's the price earnings ratio? What's the competition look like? What kind of dividend are you getting out of it? What sector are they in? Start from scratch, because if it's not passing the "I would buy this stock today if I had more cash" test, then probably you should be selling it.
All right. And Joe, what do you think about the stock? Should he hold it or sell it?
Yeah, I actually really don't have a lot to add. You use a series of criteria, and Linda, you gave yours, but you use a series of criteria to buy a stock. It all matters on if that criteria is still the same. So if it's one earnings report, but the criteria used to make the decision still exists, and you think that that criteria is correct, then you ride it out. If the criteria has changed, then you sell.
All right. Our next question comes from Nora. She says, I love your show. I started listening and I've gone back and listened to nearly every episode. Most recently, I listened to episode 73 with Wayne Connors. In the first 10 minutes of the episode, Wayne mentions rebalancing annually. I know that every investor's portfolio is unique to him or her, but is there a recommended time of year to rebalance? Have there been studies and models done regarding that? What do you suggest? Doug, I think you're probably the one that has interviewed all of the scholars and people that have written about this. What do you know about rebalancing?
Yeah, I think when we talk about modern portfolio theory, this concept that you can actually potentially increase your return and lower your risk by properly diversifying is in fact a critical concept. I actually think that Nora is asking a very, very interesting question. I can't say I've seen a specific study on whether, let me just rephrase the question, make sure that we all think it's the same thing. She's saying, let's say that you decide you want to have 50-50 stocks, bonds, and every so often you're going to rebalance that. Should you rebalance it in January or in February or in March, or should you rebalance once a year or once a quarter? All I can tell you is that in general, the financial planning software that I look at and that I've seen usually assumes a rebalancing on a yearly basis in order just to get you back into play. But the fact is, I don't know if people always do that. A lot of times, there are other factors that come into play. For example, I was just speaking to a client yesterday who said, Doug, remember back in 2008 when you told me to do tax loss harvesting? And I was glad he remembered because I didn't remember all the details. But he said that was the greatest advice because everything crashed. I wanted to be in the market. And you said, why don't you just switch from this to that? It was, you know, a similar kind of move. And this had nothing to do with rebalancing his overall portfolio, which we sort of ended up doing, but it had to do with a separate strategy. So anyway, Nora, I'm sorry, I'm not giving you an exact answer to your question, but I certainly think that on a periodic basis, let's say yearly, people really need to rebalance. And I like this question so much. I'm going to take a look at it a little bit more.
All right, Joe, how about you?
You know, I haven't seen any studies either, Linda. I don't know if you've seen any studies. The only thing I'm thinking about is volatility. And, you know, historically, September has been historically the worst month of the year for the stock market. But beyond that, and then I started thinking, if I'm rebalancing, do I want to rebalance when the market's down? Do I want to rebalance when the market's up? And I honestly have seen nothing, which leads me to believe with all the great academics that we all talk to, I'm not sure it's relevant what month you do it.
Yeah, I've never heard of a specific month that people have recommended for rebalancing. I have heard both an annual strategy and a quarterly strategy. There are some professional investors out there that prefer to rebalance on a quarterly strategy. But I think typically for most investors, annually is sufficient. And again, that's just to get your portfolio back in balance. Let's say that large caps have outperformed for an extended period of time, and you already had the biggest portion of your portfolio in large caps. Had they just continued to go and you didn't rebalance, that would mean that, you know, they could become easily 70 or plus percent of your portfolio, perhaps. So it's important to cut them back to the 50 or 40% or 60% that they were and rebalance everything back into proportion. So
yeah, let me just add something to that. Also, there are other ways that people make a decision when to rebalance. Sometimes it's periodic based on the calendar, and sometimes it's based on other thresholds. So for example, let's say that, you know, the example before, you liked a 50-50 portfolio. You might say, but if I break the 5% mark and I'm, you know, 55-45 or, you know, 56-44, that's when I'm going to rebalance. There are a lot of other factors involved in making this decision, not the least of which is, we mentioned before, the taxes, but there's time involved and there are transaction costs involved in dealing with this. So maybe that's the reason that people like to do it yearly, because there's it's not obvious that it pays to do it much more frequently. But again, the rebalancing could be done on a calendar basis or on another basis.
Okay. Our next question comes from Don. Hi, Money Tree Investing panelists. I've been listening to your show for the past year or so and have gained many valuable insights. Thank you. In particular, it's great to get multiple perspectives on the same topic as it causes me to really question my own biases and assumptions. I would like to explore one of these assumptions in more detail. Although I have a strong business background, my formal education in finance is almost 30 years old. At that time, it was strongly believed that the proper way to passively invest, even though passive index funds were in their infancy, was to try to own all investable assets in a market cap weighted portfolio. Today, the vast majority of passive funds still follow that course, but there are a number of exceptions. One alternative frequently cited on the podcast is an equal weighted S&P 500 index. At first blush, this seems similar to dollar cost averaging, as it would overweight small companies and underweight huge stagnating companies. By rebalancing, you would constantly be betting on the smaller companies in the index. As I thought a little more, though, I started to have concerns about this approach. Looking at today's market cap weightings would put Apple at a whopping 3.887% and Patterson Companies, bottom of the index, at a minuscule 0.013%. This is a ratio of close to 300 times. An equal weight index would buy the same amount of both companies. This is placing a huge bet on Patterson Companies relative to Apple. It is at about company 123 that the two indexes have the same weighting. I understand the premise that it seems easier to double the size of a very small company than a very large company, but is this true? Certainly the number of small companies that have doubled is greater than huge companies, but this could just be because the universe of small companies has many more small companies than huge. But Apple was once a small company, as was every other huge company, yet they grew and grew and grew. By equal weighting, we are betting that the top 122 companies in the index will grow less than the bottom 378. I'm not sure why I would believe that. Certainly, history shows us periods of time that mid caps and small caps have outperformed large caps, albeit at a greater volatility, but history also shows us periods where large caps have outperformed. Doesn't this just make the idea of equal weighting another market timing game easy to see in hindsight, but impossible to predict? Wow. That's quite the analysis. I would just say that I'm not sure we've talked about an equal weighted portfolio. When I talk about an S&P 500 portfolio, I'm not talking about an equally weighted portfolio. And the problem is, though, that the market weighting is much larger, much heavier for those larger companies, and they do have a market weighting. So you're going to have the larger companies like Alphabet and Apple, et cetera, have more market weight than other companies. But what do you think about this, Joe? Is it something that we want to do to have equally weighted funds or not?
I think we're looking at an apple and an orange here, because I think that he makes a really good point, which is that by equal weighting the S&P 500, you are really increasing the standard deviation. The smaller a company is, the more it's going to bounce around. And so you're increasing your risk by going with an equal weight versus the weighted S&P 500. So for me, I think there's actually room in a portfolio for both, but I think that they're two different beasts, right? I think that the, to his point, the equal weight S&P 500 is going to be much more of a growth animal than the S&P 500, which really is a blend. So I think realizing that that equal weight's going to bounce around more means that, to his point, you're not getting a free lunch with the S&P equal weight. It's just, it's a different beast.
Yeah, I agree. And not one that I normally would recommend. What about you, Doug?
So this is the argument that I often make to people about why they shouldn't just put all of their money into an S&P 500 fund, for example, because really it means they're just betting on Apple, mostly on it. That's the biggest position that you're going to have there, unless that's what you want to do. The problem is just that the size of the markets today mean that when companies that want to create index funds actually put something together, it has to be these bigger companies. Because if you have a tiny little company, like you mentioned, in the index, and this index fund is going to have hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars, there are not enough shares to go around of this little company in order to make it, you know, equally balanced in the portfolio. So it's not so easy, let's just say, to make an equally balanced portfolio. There is no one right answer on this. But I think that the risk that people have to realize if they're going to go into any sort of indexing is understanding that most index funds, I believe, are market weight, are capitalization weighted, meaning the bigger companies weigh a lot more. And that means that you're making a bet on those companies. Another method that's very common would be, for example, how the Dow Jones Industrial Average is calculated, which is not a capitalization weighted index, but it's actually a price weighted index, which when you think about it is kind of insane. What it really means is that if you have two stocks and one of them is trading at $80 a share and one of them is trading at $40 a share, regardless of the size and the capitalization of the company, the stock which is trading at $80 a share will have twice the impact on that index. So it becomes very, very strange when you actually look at the math that goes on in calculating these indices. And I think this is an eye-opener that I'm glad we're talking about today for people to realize that there are many, many different ways to skin this cat. And don't just assume, oh, I'm going to throw all my money into indices because that's going to solve my problems.
Good point. Well, that concludes our questions for today. Thank you, everybody, for sending in your questions. We so appreciate it. And that was another fun round of Q&A. Joe, tell us what's going on at Stacking Benjamins and how people can get more from you.
We have a brand new five-day-a-week podcast called Money in the Morning. It's just 15 minutes, and we just go over two headlines from recent financial planning news. So if you're looking for a short podcast on your commute, look us up there, Money in the Morning, it's called, and you can find it wherever finer podcasts are listened to, like ours.
And it's a good one, too. I highly recommend it. And Doug, what's going on at Goldstein on Gelt?
Yeah, I have to say, I also enjoy Money in the Morning. It's nice to get a good touch of a good understanding of what's going on in the market today. One of the things I want to mention is that we're finding a lot of U.S. brokerage firms who have clients who live outside the United States are telling those clients that they can no longer be a client there. And in fact, we've got a webinar on it on my corporate website at profile-financial.com, simply called Why You Need a U.S. Broker to Live Overseas. And I think that people who are getting these letters from their brokers, that, by the way, anyone in America is not going to understand this. They're going to say, why would a brokerage firm kick someone out? And the answer is that the regulations in the U.S. are so complicated for companies that want to do business overseas that they prefer just to give up on the business rather than deal with those regulations. And so we teach a lot about that at profile-financial.com.
Fantastic. And over at Be Wealthy and Smart, I'm talking about the best performing large cap stocks for the past 1, 3, 5, and 10 years that have outperformed the S&P 500. So if you're looking for where is the performance happening, I have a report for you at Be Wealthy and Smart. Well, that's all we have for you today. We would love to have a review from you and have you visit our website at moneytreepodcast.com. Remember, no one cares about your money as much as you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.